To the Sermon on the Mount, and I would draw your attention particularly to verses 31 to 32, where we read in Matthew chapter 5, "Furthermore, it has been said, whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce. But I say to you that whoever divorces his wife for any reason, except sexual immorality, causes her to commit adultery. And whoever marries a woman who is divorced commits adultery." In these words, we are clearly confronted with what is a very sensitive issue and a very live issue in our modern society, but also within the church. And we're reminded that this is not unique to this age, that even in the days in which Jesus walked upon this earth and engaged in ministry, the question of marriage, the impact of sin upon marriage, the possibility of divorce, complications relating to that, and the question of remarriage were very much live issues for the people of God then as well as they are today. The question of divorce, by its very nature and consequences, raises for all involved deep emotions. It's a reality that people hold strong views, perhaps shaped by the Bible, perhaps by personal experience or other influences. But before we look at what Jesus is saying here, I want to note a couple of things. First, I want to remind you that this is not just some abstract comment of the Lord Jesus Christ. It forms part of a collection of responses of Jesus to popular views in the religious circles and the religious life of the people. It's part of a series of antitheses. You have heard it said, but I say. So we need to recognize as we hear this that this is yet another one of these in which Jesus is asserting that he is the great prophet, that he is speaking with the full authority of the Creator God and Sovereign Lord. But as we think of that, we need then to remember with that that Jesus is not expounding the Old Testament law. He is responding to distortions of the Old Testament law in the life and practice of God's people. That's what he's addressing here. It is only an exposition of the Old Testament to the law as is needed to challenge, to correct the fallacy of the religious leaders and the outworking of that in community life amongst God's people. If we remember that, it'll keep us from the trap of neglecting the fact that other things are taught in the scripture on these issues. It will also keep us from the trap of thinking that Paul stands in conflict to Christ on this particular issue. The second thing I want us to bear in mind is that there is a connection between this issue in verses 31 and 32 with the two issues on either side of it. We notice that verse 31 begins with, "Furthermore." Jesus has just been talking about adultery, and that adultery begins in the heart. And that is not just a precursor of adultery, it's actually a form of adultery. There may be a scale between the thought compared to the act, but we ought not to disconnect the realities, Jesus is saying. And then he says, "Furthermore, having given you the example of lust as an expression of adultery," he now talks about divorce in the same light. That this too can be an expression of adultery. Furthermore, And then in verse 33, he says, and or again, indicating that, again, he's still on the same thread. And here he is talking about vows, the making of oaths, and highlighting, as we will see, God willing, next time, the issue of integrity of our speech, our trustworthiness. And we can see how that obviously impacts upon marriage. For every young man and young woman, or older man and young woman, who stands before God and the congregation with a purpose of being married, undertakes what? Vows and promises. How serious will you take it? So you see, there is a flow here. So let's not lose sight of that. There is a natural progression of thought. And that if we understand clearly both the issue of lust and the issue of integrity of our vows, it will help us in the issue of protecting and promoting our marriage and marital life and love. Now, against that general framework, let us look more specifically at verses 31 and 32. In verse 31, Jesus says, furthermore, it has been said. So here's what he's criticizing. This is what the people were basing their views of marriage and divorce upon. Whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce. Let him give her a certificate of divorce. Just by way of other background here, Jesus is addressing the man first, because in the Old Testament that's where it is addressed, but it's not to the exclusion of the woman as well. It doesn't mean that women can't divorce husbands. It's focusing upon the man, but it's inclusive of the woman. What Jesus is highlighting here is a disagreement that occurred within the Pharisees and other religious leaders, between those who had been considered liberals in their views to others being ultra-conservative or narrow in their views, on the issue of the legitimate grounds of divorce. But what Jesus is saying is that despite those differences, which we will explore in a moment, they were united upon this truth, that you could divorce. And if a divorce was to take place, you were to give a certificate of divorce. That this was the key thing. The giving of a certificate of divorce. This revolved around the Old Testament reading that we read from the book of Deuteronomy, in Deuteronomy chapter 24 and verses 1 in particular, but reading through to verse 4 in more general terms. They focused upon verse 1. What we will find Jesus doing here is focusing upon the whole package deal, and indeed, the tone and spirit of the whole chapter. That is why in Matthew chapter 19, where Jesus is engaged more specifically with these religious leaders on this question, as distinct from here, he's just talking in general to those who are following him in this Sermon on the Mount. The audiences are different, but the issue is approached the same way by Jesus. They said to him, why then did Moses command to give a certificate of divorce and to put her away? Notice what they are saying. They saw it as a command. You have to give the certificate of divorce and you have to put her away. In other words, divorce wasn't an issue to them. They believed they had a biblical warrant to divorce. The only dispute was the grounds for the divorce. But they saw no problems with the issue of divorce itself. So long as you issued the certificate of divorce to the wife being sent away, as far as they were concerned, you fulfilled all righteousness. And this is the key issue for the Pharisees. They were concerned to fulfill all righteousness as they understood it. And Jesus has the same concern when he says on the Sermon on the Mount that our righteousness has to exceed that of the scribes and the Pharisees. But they thought that fulfilling all righteousness was to make sure that you give a certificate. In other words, Jesus then is not quoting Deuteronomy 24 here. He is quoting their interpretation of it, and that's what he's responding to. But when you look back to Deuteronomy 24, which we don't really have time to work our way through, I would suggest that you find certain things concerning it. One is that it is not a command, but a recognition. They are not commanded to divorce. What Deuteronomy chapter 24 is about is protecting the innocent. That was the purpose of a certificate. But more than that, it was about protecting marriage, protecting a low view of marriage. The prohibition actually comes in verse 4 of Deuteronomy 24, not in verse 1. Verse 1 is a description of what Moses saw and that God clearly permitted. But in verse 4, it talks about the man who treats his wife like a used chariot. He likes his chariot, he's bought his chariot. It doesn't use that illustration, I'm just sort of modernising it a little bit, trying to get you a feel for what Deuteronomy 24, I was going to say bought a V8 Holden Ute, but let's stick with the chariot. He bought a chariot, looks really good, he's acknowledged, he's noted around town, but someone else then comes with a better chariot, or a new one has been released on the market 6 months later, and he says, I've got to trade this one in and get that one, and he gets that one, and he thinks, oh, that was a bit of a lemon, I prefer my other one. So he sells that one and tries to buy the other one back. Now what is reasonably okay in the marketplace, it's a wisdom issue, but when it comes to marriage, it's not okay. That's what Deuteronomy 24 is highlighting here. That you cannot treat your wife as property. When she doesn't suit you, you get rid of her, you try something else. If that doesn't work, you can come back. No. You can't do that. That's the regulation. Give her a certificate. But as you give the certificate, understand the consequences of divorce. That's what God is doing here. He's slowing down the process towards divorce. To get a certificate means you have to go through some form of legal process and administration and public recognition. It means you have to think about what you're doing. And more than that, Moses is highlighting the fact that there are consequences that will impact upon your life as well as the life of the one that you are divorcing. You need to think about those consequences. The whole of chapter 24 is about family relationships in one way or another. It's about sin and its consequences. You need to be serious about sin, but you also, in dealing with sin, must not forget to be compassionate. It's not about self. It's not about selfishness. You must always consider the consequences for yourself, but particularly for others. How can I care for them in the light of the actions that I am about to take? Read again Deuteronomy 24 and you'll see that reality. And that's what Jesus begins to highlight here. Moses is discouraging divorce by means of regulation without necessarily forbidding it, but at the same time protecting the rights of those divorced, particularly women, who would find it hard to provide for themselves. And in that situation and time would naturally look again at marriage. And as Jay Adams points out, the impact of this is really, you better think twice about divorcing her, because if you can't get her to remarry you before she marries you, you will have lost the opportunity forever. So what is actually happening in Deuteronomy 24? Well, what is happening is what Jesus draws attention to. It's not really about divorce. It's about protecting marriage. It's about strengthening the marriage bond. It's about making people think about the marriage bond, the priority of marriage, of making ourselves work at our marriages. God is protecting the integrity of marriage. Don't treat it like the way you might treat a chariot or an old pair of sandals in the hope of getting a better pair of shoes. The way you might treat a servant is not the way you treat your wife. In fact, as you read on, you shouldn't even treat a servant that way. God, through Moses, was leading Israel back to a higher view of marriage. It's given by God in the book of Genesis. And that's the point that Jesus is making both here and in the direct confrontation with the religious leaders in Matthew 19. They had put the focus on divorce. And when marriages get difficult, that's where we tend to want to focus. So if there's an easy way out, those views tend to become popular. But Jesus puts the focus on where it should have been all along, where Moses put it, and that is on marriage. To Jesus, marriage is precious, and the marriage vow vital. Not hard to understand why in the light of the rest of the New Testament, is it? But even in the light of the Old Testament, that Jesus is the husband of his church, his bride. He's our husband. He's committed to the marriage with us. He sealed it with his own blood. He perseveres. He's patient. He's redeemed us. He's cleansed us. He's strengthening us. He's preparing us to stand beside him at the throne in eternal glory and splendor, pure and undefiled, equal with him. Amazing reality. Jesus is our husband. And our marriages are to picture that, Paul reminds us. And in that we see that surely we too must cultivate within the church a high view of marriage. We must discourage the attitude that grumbles under a marriage and is always looking for some easy way out. To hear that that is an adulterous act. Loving the state of being free or free to remarry above the present marital partner is just another variation of lust. John Stott communicates a wise pastoral practice when he said, "For some years now, I have followed a simple rule that whenever anyone asks me a question about divorce, I refuse to answer it until I first talked about two subjects. Firstly, or namely, marriage and reconciliation." He's highlighting the fact that it's so easy for us to get sucked into a discussion of the lower option, particularly when people are obviously hurting. And our heart breaks in it or because of it with them. But we are to find ways to follow Jesus and his priorities. We need to be asking, what are we actually doing to promote marriage, to promote a high view of marriage in our home, in the homes of our friends, in the public square, in the private homes of the world around us? That's why we give instruction prior to marriage. But you notice also that that's why the Bible focuses on support within marriage. In Titus chapter 2, verses 3 to 5, it describes the particularly blessed role of older women in the life of the congregation in a particular area of ministry. It's not their only opportunity for ministry, but it is a serious one. And that is to get alongside young brides and young mothers and to teach them. Teach them what? How to love their husbands. How to love their husbands. If you read on in the book of Deuteronomy, having just in those first four verses wrestled with the question of divorce, it's instructive and startling that in the fifth verse, the next verse, it says, now when a guy gets married, he's to be free from civil obligations for a year. Why? Why is he exempt from military service, from court service, from temple service, from whatever else is happening that others are involved in? Because he has to learn to understand his wife, to love her. The community takes his workload. His neighbours carry that role for 12 months so that he can focus on laying a strong foundation for his marriage that will strengthen and help them into the future. That's the priority that Jesus is drawing attention to in the passages where he speaks about marriage and divorce. The sad reality is that as in Jesus' day, so many embrace marriage with an understanding of the commitment that it speaks of, that it should be enduring, that there are mutual vows designed to promote confidence and security within that marriage. But they embrace it at the same time keeping that emergency eject button handy in their pocket. And if things get difficult, even if I'm not contemplating to divorce my spouse, we all need to be asking, am I in principle doing so by my lack of interest, lack of involvement, withdrawal of love, withdrawal of concern and support? We need to recognize there's such a thing as a de facto divorce, separation within the home, within the marriage. Are we guilty of it despite appearances to the contrary? Jesus challenges the evasion to love your marriage, to work at your marriage, to fight for your marriage, to honour God in your marriage. And yet, having said that, Jesus also knows that there are times that are extremely difficult and put an incredible strain upon marriage, and he doesn't want to unfairly burden his disciples. And so he goes on in verse 32 to certify an exemption. We notice in verse 32 that Jesus says, except. I say to you that whoever divorces his wife for any reason except sexual immorality. There's an exception here. There is a biblical ground, in other words, Jesus sets before us for legitimate divorce. These other grounds are not legitimate. This one is, in the eyes of Jesus. Again, we need to go back to the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 24 and verse 41. The issue of the debate between the two schools of thought and the Pharisees revolved around the meaning in verse 1 of Deuteronomy 24 of the phrase, if you find some uncleanness in her. Rabbi Hillel taught that the phrase means anything. Anything that was offensive to the husband. Yeah, she just burnt the toast too many times. She can't cook. She can't see clearly and as a result, the house is always dusty. She thinks it's clean, but it's not. You should see the mess she makes of the plates, always leaving something behind on the plate after they're washed. And it's awkward when I bring visitors home. The cups are always got this stain in the bottom. Whatever it might be. It might be that she snores. It could be her BO. It could be that she's not as pretty and young as she used to be. The passage of time. Any reason. That was okay. So long as you gave a certificate of divorce. Rabbi Shamir objected to that. He held a much stricter view. He limited it to adultery and said that it was an obligation to divorce such a wife, the one who had become an adulteress. Here we find that Jesus declares that sexual immorality is a ground for legitimate divorce. That's a word that is a general term for sexual sin, sexual immorality, fornication. We have examples of it given in the New Testament that apart from the actual act of adultery, in 1 Corinthians 5:1, it is used to describe incest. In 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verses 13 and 18, it's used to describe those who avail themselves of prostitution. In chapter 7 and verse 2, it covers the issue of premarital sex. It includes all of these things, and basically anything that violates the one flesh reality that is established in marriage. Now, those who heard Jesus say this would most likely then say, he's aligning himself with Shemaiah. He's distancing himself from Hillel, but he's agreeing with Shemaiah. Yet those who thought a little deeper would have realized he wasn't actually agreeing with Shemaiah at all. For Jesus was careful not to command divorce, but merely to permit it. It is possible. It is permissible. He's not encouraging it, but he's not forbidding it. He is saying it is possible. And if you take that road, you are without sin, is what Jesus is saying. Christians who are committed to reconciliation ought to be encouraged, surely, by the power of God's grace to see that even the most severe cases of sexual infidelity in a marriage can yet overcome the breaking apart of that marriage. A marriage can be saved. Yet Jesus recognizes the devastating effect of sexual immorality upon a marriage. And I think also at the same time the practical reality that those who are the adulterers against that marriage don't tend to want to save their marriage. And so it becomes practically impossible, despite efforts towards reconciliation, to actually achieve it. They've become so entangled with a new person, they're not interested to work at solving the issues in their marriage. And therefore, Jesus declares that such a divorce, if pursued by the one sinned against, is not sinful. Guarding their innocence as so far as it goes to this matter, if they pursue divorce. But you notice also at the same time that Jesus is stressing here that sexual infidelity does not itself dissolve the marriage. I want to say that because over the years that one has come back to me so many times, that they've committed adultery and therefore they've destroyed the marriage. The marriage is dead. No, it's not. It's the divorce that dissolves the marriage, not the sin, even of adultery. The marriage can be saved. Yet by implication, should the one offended against pursue a divorce, Jesus clearly is indicating here that that one is free to remarry. For by that except, they do not find themselves under the other's condemnation. He is no longer under obligation to the former wife or she to the former husband. As clearly the case of those sinfully divorced, whether though the marriage has ended, the obligation to each other clearly is seen by Jesus to continue. Otherwise there would be no adultery. That speaks of obligation. Of obligation sinned against. So what happens when two Christians divorce for other reasons? Well, Paul picks this up in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verses 10 to 12, confirming Jesus' teaching by saying that they should not divorce, but if they do, they should remain unmarried with a view to reconcile, which obviously means to remarry. There's no hint of sexual infidelity or immorality there. So they're not free to marry another, is what Paul is saying. Their obligation is to seek by God's grace over time to reconcile and to remarry. Again, the divorce has dissolved the marriage, so they will need to remarry. And if they engage in sexual relationships after the divorce, then they are sinning. And neither partner has the right to demand it, to demand conjugal rights in that situation. But you'd be surprised how often that card is played in marital difficulties, even amongst professing Christians. The result of their sinful divorce is that they are married. It's the same word as used, unmarried is the same word as used in verses 8 and 9, but they are still under obligation to each other because the divorce which resulted in the unmarried state was sinful. Understanding this context also helps us to understand why Paul goes on to give another exception against divorce in verses 13 following, where Paul speaks with apostolic authority, not contradicting Christ, but dealing with an issue that Christ did not purposefully explore. And that is the situation facing the people of God that has been broadened through missionary activity, where through evangelism, mixed marriages have resulted. One has been converted and the other one says, "You're not what I married." And the unbeliever says, "I don't want to be married to a Christian. If you don't deny Christ, our marriage is over." The Christian seeks to work at that marriage, says Paul. Doesn't try and push buttons to get them to divorce. But if the unbeliever asks for a divorce, the believer does not stand in the way of the dissolution of the marriage. The exception concerns, in other words, a divorce instigated by an unbelieving husband, not manipulated by a conniving spouse who may be a Christian and really would prefer to be free from an unbelieving husband or married to a Christian spouse. And Paul says that such a person, divorced by an unbeliever, is no longer under bondage, verse 15. In other words, it's free to marry in the Lord. It's the same word used of the widow in verse 39. She's no longer bound because her husband has died. She's free to marry. So if the one is loosed and encouraged to be able to remarry, then it should apply to the other, unless there is a clear alteration of thought, which there is not. Now I want to take you a little bit further into verse 32. And this is a little bit difficult. If you thought that last point was a bit intense, stick with me. For Jesus says that if anyone divorces for any reason except sexual immorality, he's causing her to commit adultery. And whoever marries a woman who is divorced commits adultery. What Jesus is doing here is bringing us back to the spirit of Deuteronomy chapter 24, highlighting the horrendous moral and social consequences of sin. In this case, of easy divorce by a husband who's using the law to his own personal advantage, having no except clause, only a certificate to give to his wife. It's widely acknowledged that the Greek here is very difficult, and it is so because Jesus doesn't use what we would expect at this point, the use of a noun, an adulteress, to describe the woman in view, the wife in view. But the verb translated to commit adultery, and it's in the passive, which also adds confusion. What does that mean? Some have suggested it should be translated, and you'll see it in some translations, to suffer adultery. And they think of it in terms of being stigmatized by the community as an adulteress. But the fact that she has a certificate, I think, works against the idea of public stigma. So how do we deal with a passage with this passive verb? In John chapter 8, verse 4, I think helps us. For the woman that is brought before Jesus by the religious leaders, for Jesus to adjudicate her case, we have described using the passive verb, caught in adultery. She was caught in adultery. And yet, in the next breath, we're also told she was caught in the very act of adultery. So she was in the action of adultery, not just caught in adultery. It was not just something done to her. At the same time, it was something she was doing. It's an interesting double take there. Apparently, the passive then was meant to indicate that her adultery was of a responsive rather than an initiating nature. That she was not the instigator, though she was clearly involved and a participant. And when you think of that, it fits in with the statement of Jesus in Matthew chapter 5 when he says that the husband divorcing her for any other reason causes her to commit adultery or to suffer adultery. That causes her has the sense of to put on display, to draw attention to highlight, to declare. And when we look at that and bring it together, it tells us that Jesus is seeing her as a victim. Read the verse again. Jesus is looking at her as a victim. She has not committed adultery, but she is being one who is regarded as committing adultery. By sinfully divorcing his wife, the husband, by that, has become a contributing partner to her adultery if she remarries, when she remarries, which clearly could not have occurred if she didn't remarry. Jesus is confronting, in other words, such men with the consequence for the wife that they have wrongly divorced. It's as if Jesus is saying, stop thinking of what you want, of how your life will be better, how your life will be easier. What about your wife? Look at the potential situation you put her into so that she will find herself caught up in this whole issue of adultery. But it's primarily of your making because you have divorced her without biblical warrant. You've managed it according to procedures and practices, but there is no biblical warrant. Can you be so heartless? This is the compassion that oozes out of Deuteronomy 24 that we see stimulating Jesus to cry to the wife who is being abused by her husband through divorce in this situation. Jesus wants the man to see his own personal culpability in the resulting sin should she remarry. Should he say, but what happens in her life after the divorce is not my problem. I'm not a husband anymore. I fulfilled all righteousness. Jesus would be responding here, you were wrong. You were wrong. By saying he causes her, Jesus is laying stress on his sin, of which she has become a victim. Saying he also is culpable for any sin on her part that results as a result of that divorce that was sinful in the first place. And Jesus is saying, mate, you cannot untangle yourself from a share of responsibility in that sin, in her situation. In short, what Jesus is saying, and he's saying loudly across the centuries to us today, look at the rotten mess that a selfish view of marriage and divorce leads to. What it causes for all concerned, yourself included, before God. It is far better to face up to the responsibilities of marriage and to work through the problems within a marriage. This is the norm. And though there are two categories of possible exemption, which do not involve guilt either for the divorce or future entanglements of sin that the other party may get up to, even there, Jesus' preferred option is to work at the marriage. Anything less opens floodgates in a spreading moral tragedy. Jesus is stressing the real risk and often the trend of focus upon oneself with little thought to, little care of, for the implication of another. He is stressing that divorce is never a simple or easy option or without horrific consequences. We often see the social ones, but Jesus here is particularly drawing attention to the moral ones. Clearly, the complexity of divorce, as Jesus raises it, shows us the importance of careful consideration together and, it would seem, wisely with the elders within the church, to seek wise pastoral counsel and care in that context. But it also says to the rest of us, not only must we protect our own marriages and work at them and invest in them honestly and sincerely and be tender and compassionate and patient, forgiving of one another. It also lays upon us as a congregation a responsibility to pray for and encourage those who are struggling with the realities of marital difficulties or of divorce and its consequences. And for those who are divorced, for those who are in marriage difficulties, we need to remember that the Jesus who speaks here is the Jesus who speaks through Isaiah as the servant who does not crush the bruised reed. He doesn't put out the wick. Deuteronomy 24 says, exercise wisdom with compassion. Jesus in Matthew 5, Matthew 19, Paul in 1 Corinthians 7 is saying the same thing. Wisdom with compassion shaped by the word of God. And that's the Jesus you and I deal with. That's how he operates. He is our husband, cares for us in the situations of the struggles of our life. We ought to look to him for healing grace, for forgiving grace, for restoring grace, for renewing grace. The one who is the husband of an imperfect bride, the church, you and I, knows the commitment, the need of forgiveness, the need of perseverance that is required. Do not think that he cannot help. Above all, Jesus calls us to have a high view of marriage, to take seriously our wedding vows, to show this to our spouses, to set it clearly before our children, before our neighbours, for our families and society, with grateful and thankful hearts for what God has given us, for who God has given us in Christ Jesus. Let us pray. Father, help us to